We'll take good care of it, Selma said. How many volumes are there?
About 20, Oliver said.
And one's missing? The one detailing the theft of the Grey Ghost. Any other volumes mention the car? Selma asked.
A couple of them do, Oliver said, apparently well-versed on what they contained.
One's from World War II. It details when Uncle Albert's father hid the car in the barn we found it in.
What about local experts? Selma asked. Anyone else who knows the history of your car? Might be worth talking to.
Actually, there is, Oliver said. The mechanic who worked on the Grey Ghost. We picked him because of his expertise in Rolls-Royce restoration.
Exactly how much work did he do on the car? Sam asked.
Had the car for a good fortnight before we got it back.
Surely he would have mentioned something if he'd found anything important, wouldn't he?
Oliver glared at the diary, then at them.
Blast it all.
I'm being naive about that, aren't I? Sam glanced at Remy. Guess we know where we're off to next.
Chapter 23.
The moment Arthur Oren stepped out of his townhouse, down the steps to the front walk, Colton's black Mercedes rolled up. One of the things he liked about the man, his extreme punctuality. If he said he was going to be somewhere at a certain time, he made it happen.
I trust things are going according to plan, Oren asked as he slid into the passenger seat.
Colton checked the side mirror, then pulled away from the curb.
As expected. As long as everyone keeps their end of the bargain, we should be fine.
Arthur looked at him, but the man's gaze was fixed out the window, presumably on the traffic.
What do you mean by that?
Exactly what it sounds like. Everyone knows their part. The payments are made. I expect all to continue without issues. To Arthur it sounded almost like a veiled threat, but he chose to let it go. For now. He didn't want anything to ruin this moment. They were finally on their way to see the Grey Ghost, find the secrets it held, and take the next step in securing his fortune and his hold on the Peyton Estates. All the planning, all the dreams were finally coming to fruition, and he settled back in his seat, forcing himself to relax during the drive. Colton, however, broke the silence with the worst sort of news.
The old man has a solicitor. My understanding is, he's very reputable.
Reputable meant competent, something they'd hoped to avoid.
He was supposed to be destitute, Oren said.
How can a man who hasn't a cent to his name afford that?
Oliver, it seems, has convinced the Fargos that his uncle is worthy of their help. They hired the attorney.
Out of the goodness of their hearts? I find that hard to believe. There has to be some sort of collateral. They barely know.
He stopped. Looked over at Colton.
The only thing of value Oliver and his uncle have left besides Peyton Manor was the Grey Ghost.
Maybe that's it,
Colton said, signaling for a right turn, never once looking at Oren.
It'd make sense.
Not that it'll do them much good. They're hoping to recover the ghost, no doubt, and we both know that won't happen.
Oren drummed his fingers on the center console, his well-manicured nails clicking on the burled wood. They could hope all they wanted. The Peytons were never getting their hands on that car again.
Even so, he wouldn't relax until he'd completed the rest of his plan. They needed to keep the Peytons' finances on the brink, one step away from disaster, all so Oren could deliver the final blow and see them ruined forever. That would be his vindication, he thought, suddenly noticing that Colton had slowed down considerably. The road leading to the warehouse was a straight shot, the better to see anyone approaching.
Is something wrong?
Colton eyed the buildings, checked his rearview mirror. It never hurts to take precautions. I don't like surprises.
Neither do I.
Now, back to the Fargos. What do you intend to do about them?
That depends on how involved they plan on getting. If they're merely offering up the services of this solicitor and his investigator, have at it, I say.
What if they get the old man off? They won't. The evidence is irrefutable. Otherwise, the police wouldn't have made an arrest. So far, all they've received is a copy of the police report and the video, neither of which will do them any good.
You'd better be right, he said, as they cruised past the warehouse. Colton pulled around and parked in the back. After all the problems Oliver has caused, the last thing we need is more distractions.
Colton looked at him as he shut off the engine. Distractions being the key word. It won't alter the end game. As I said, everything's going as planned.
Really? Oren asked as they got out and walked up to the warehouse door. I thought you were planning on taking the Fargos out. What happened with that plan?
A slight setback is all. They've turned out to be a bit more troublesome than anticipated.
How hard is it to knock off two socialites?
Colton gave him a sidelong glance as he paused to light a cigarette.
He blew out a long stream of smoke, then said, Is that what you think they are? Or did you not read the dossier I sent?
I did, but I thought you were better than that.
Because I am better than that. Their social status is exactly why we can't kill them without careful planning, especially after that fiasco at the Peyton warehouse. Like it or not, they're connected to Oliver. If they go, it needs to appear unconnected to the Peytons, or you'll risk scrutiny when you take over the estate.
Deep down, he knew Colton was right. It was, after all, why he hired the man, to make sure mistakes weren't made.
Maybe step up the planning.
Colton ignored him as he unlocked the door and the two stepped inside. Cigarette hanging from his mouth, he keyed the code into the alarm pad, switched on the lights. The two men turned around, staring at the empty space.
Colton ripped the cigarette from his mouth, dropped it onto the ground. I don't understand.
He pulled out his phone, called one of his men.
Where's the gray ghost?
The volume was high enough for Oren to hear the silence at first before his man said, What are you talking about? It was right there last night when I set the alarm.
Well, it's gone.
It took a moment for Oren to register what he was seeing and hearing. When he finally came to his senses, he looked over at Colton.
Tell me again. How everything's going according to plan.
Chapter 24
Allegra was ambitious, which is why it troubled her to know that Oliver, someday to be the 8th Viscount Wellswick, cared less about the title and more about the farmers. She, on the other hand, had a son to think about, which was what made their family history so interesting. Chances were good that if Oliver continued down the path he was on, her son would inherit everything. Whether there'd be anything left to inherit remained to be seen, she thought, looking over at her ex-husband, Dex Northcott, who sat at the dining table reading while he ate the leftovers she'd hoped to save for dinner. A slow reader, he turned a page, paused to look over at the television in the front room where a football game was on. The player dribbled the ball past the defense, then kicked it. When the goalkeeper caught it, Dex turned back to the book. The 5th Journal, which told the story of the Grey Ghost, stolen in 1906, and how an American detective named Isaac Bell had helped to find it, all while he was hunting down a group of notorious bank robbers. She regretted the day she'd ever told him that story, one she'd first read when she was about her son's age, her early teens, after Oliver had found and read it. Back then, she'd thought it was all made up, one of her ancestors having a bit of fun with their family history. It wasn't until her uncle had brought out the Grey Ghost, hidden in a barn on the property, that she'd even recalled the story. Apparently, she wasn't the only one.
Mum?
She nearly jumped. Her son Trevor was staring at her.
Did you want something? I asked where the Nutella was.
Same place as always, in the cupboard.
We're out.
Dex gave them an annoyed look. Do you mind? It's hard enough reading this ancient cursive without you two making all that noise.
Loud cheering broke out on the television, and he looked that direction but was unable to see because Trevor was standing in the way. Swearing, he slammed the book onto the table, then stalked around the boy and into the front room.
"Let's have a look, shall we?" Allegra said, walking over to the cupboard and opening it.
"Imagine. Right where I told you it was," she said, pulling out the Nutella jar. When she turned around to hand it to him, he'd picked up the journal from the table and was reading through the pages.
"Why is Dad reading this? Looks pretty old."
"It's nothing," she said. "Belongs to the manor." He turned away when she tried to take it from him.
"Is it Uncle Albert's?"
"Sort of." One thing Trevor had developed over the years he'd lived with her uncle was a deep and abiding love for the man, which meant she had to be careful if she didn't want him to develop an inordinate interest in the book. All it would take was a few computer clicks, and he was bound to start linking some of the more unusual goings-on with what was in that journal. Since that was the last thing she needed, she gave a casual shrug. "His great-great-great-grandfather, or some such, known for his tall tales, according to Uncle Albert."
"Really?"
He turned another page and walked out of the room, forgetting about his sudden need for food. She would have gone after him if her cell phone hadn't buzzed, and she had to backtrack to the front room to find it, where she'd left it on the coffee table. Annoyed and disturbed when she saw the caller ID, she answered.
"I told you not to call me here," she said, lowering her voice.
"The Grey Ghost is missing."
Before she even had a chance to process his words, her ex-husband moved in behind her, grabbing her phone so that he could hear the call as well. Her heart started thumping.
"Missing?"
was all she could manage.
"How?"
she finally added. "We're still trying to figure that out."
"Did you have a chance to search it?"
"Not yet. Who's good for it?"
"Good for what?" she asked.
"Who do you think has the car? Who stole it?"
With no idea what to say, she closed her eyes, feeling Dex's hot breath on her fingers as he gripped them and the phone, listening in on the call.
"Chad,"
he whispered in her ear. She pulled away, looking at him, confused. He pointed to the phone, mouthing the name again.
"Chad?" she said aloud.
Dex nodded.
"Who's Chad?" the caller asked.
"The mechanic he hired. Supposed to be one of the foremost experts on those antique clunkers. The only one who knew he had the car to begin with. Oliver is on his way to see him tomorrow."
She heard the faint squeaking of the chair in the office.
"I have to go. My son's home."
"I'll call tomorrow." The phone beeped when the call ended.
"Nicely done," Dex said.
"What are you talking about?
Who else would take the car?"
He turned toward the dining table, grabbed her arm, holding it tight.
"Where's the journal?"
Her heart skipped a beat at the anger in his eyes.
"Trevor has it."
"How'd that happen?"
"Because you're an idiot," she wanted to say.
"It was sitting on the table. He saw it and picked it up. And you didn't think to take it from him?"
"I didn't want to draw attention to it."
"I know my son," she said, a subtle dig that Dex had never been there for them. "It's bad enough that he's questioning your presence here. He'll grow tired of reading it and get back to his computer. We just have to wait."
He squeezed harder, his fingers digging painfully into her flesh.
"Are you quite finished?" she asked, refusing to cry out.
"For now."
He pushed her arm away in disgust, stormed over to the armchair, sitting down with enough force to move the heavy piece of furniture back a few inches. Long ago, she'd learned that it was better to remain on an even keel when dealing with him. Now that he was back, it was even more important. For Trevor's sake. She walked to the office, peeking in the door, her son barely noticing her, absorbed in reading the diary. Trevor had taken over the room after her divorce, somehow putting together a computer from the boxes of electrical equipment that her ex had left behind, then working a part-time job and buying a newer desktop. These days, he was perfectly happy staying in that room, glued to the monitor, doing, well, whatever it was he did on the computer. The only time he came out was when he had to go to school or to eat. In the past, his isolation worried her. Now, however, she was grateful. It kept him out of Dex's affairs. She looked back toward her ex, his focus on the telly. Perfect. Quietly, she stepped into the office. According to Trevor's teachers, his comprehension of the written word, unlike his father's, was more than brilliant. He retained nearly everything he read. Moving closer, she peered over his shoulder to see what he was reading. Chapter 25. Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Wellswick, 1906. "'Twas my fault. I tried to grab the boy's wrist, but he saw us, taking off down the alley as fast as a cellar rat chased by a cat. Isaac Bell and I raced after him. When we emerged from the alley to the street beyond, there was no sign of the child. Isaac, certain he couldn't have gone far in that time, drew me back into the alley, insisting we wait, in his words, for however long it takes. We hunkered down near a refuse pile, the smell of soured trash almost overpowering at first, then fading as our senses dulled. Isaac and I both wore heavy overcoats and gloves, protecting us from the cold. The child had neither, and the quick glimpse of his arm I'd seen at the shop told me that the patched sleeve of his threadbare coat was far too thin to offer much warmth. As the cold permeated through my heavy layers, I felt certain the child must have escaped or was freezing to death somewhere because of our presence. About to suggest that we split up and begin a search, Isaac pointed to our left. The child emerged from an alcove across the street, where stairs led down to a basement door of the mercantile building. He hovered at the top of the stairs, edged his way out, raced round the corner. Isaac and I followed as the boy ran toward the railroad tracks. "We have him," Isaac said, bolting down the street. I could scarce keep up with the detective as he raced after the child, cornering him beneath the stairs of a factory about midway down the block. By the time that I caught up with him, I was completely out of breath. "We mean no harm," I said, my chest heaving. The boy cowered against the wall, his eyes wide with fright as he regarded us. He lingered on me as he slowly stood, edging away from Isaac. Suddenly, he darted past me. Isaac was faster. He grabbed the boy, lifting him in the air and holding him out as the urchin squirmed and kicked. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," the boy cried. "You can have the bread. I won't do it again. I won't." "Hush," Isaac said. "We don't care about the bread." "Let me go." "Information. We're willing to pay." Isaac looked over at me. "Show him the money." It took a moment for his words to sink in. I quickly reached for my coin purse, holding out 2 shillings for the boy to see. "Yours," I said, "if you'll talk to us." He eyed the money, his demeanor changing from scared to suspicious. But then he looked at my face, his eyes going wide. Suddenly he struggled harder, shouting, "I won't tell! I won't! I promise! I promise! Please let me go!" Isaac nearly lost his grip on the boy. "Won't tell what?" The boy refused to look up again, this time angling his eyes downward, which was when I recognized him. My father had insisted I attend a meeting at the orphanage to learn why there was a shortage of money. It had been that same day. "I saw you at the children's home." Tears sprang to the lad's eyes, and he seemed to crumple in Isaac's arms, the fierce wildcat turning into a trembling mess. "Please don't hurt me. I didn't see anything." I was about to reassure him when Isaac asked, "What didn't you see?" "That man what killed them blokes. I didn't see. I didn't." He buried his face into Isaac's chest, struggling to breathe as loud sobs racked his chest. Isaac held him tight as he looked at me over the top of the boy's head. "I believe we have found our witness." We took the boy to Isaac's suite of rooms at the Midland Hotel, where we discovered that food was a far better motivator than any amount of money. Isaac questioned him as he ate, and with each answer, I felt my world crashing in. "He's mistaken," I said, unable to believe the child's words. "There's no other explanation."
"That remains to be seen," Isaac said, sitting at a table in the parlor in front of an arched window that overlooked the street below, the click-clop of horses' hooves and the squeak of carriage wheels drifting up. Isaac looked at the open door to the next room where the child had fallen asleep on a bed.
"You believe the lad saw you and your cousin at the orphanage a few days before the robbery?"
"That had to have been it. My father asked me to have a look at the ledgers, due to a sudden shortage in funds. As patrons of the charity for the orphanage, he feels it's our responsibility to ensure that nothing was amiss."
"And what were the findings?"
"My cousin assured me the books held only one or two errors. Nothing that would suggest a mismanagement of the funds."
"Your cousin assured you? This wasn't your assessment?"
I felt a twinge of worry. "He offered to look at the books. He's much better at figures."
"Was there anyone else with you besides your cousin that afternoon?"
"Our driver."
"Did he ever leave the carriage?"
"No."
"Only you and your cousin?"
"He's not a thief."
"Quite possibly he's a murderer, which is far worse."
"Impossible. He and his wife have a newborn son. He'd never, by any chance..."
"Does your cousin gamble?"
"Occasionally. Well, I know he's had a few losses, but nothing terribly serious."
A feeling of dread came over me as I reflected on the various times Reginald had borrowed money after a night at the gambling halls. But he wasn't so heartless as to steal funds meant to feed the poor and destitute.
Or was he? If he could do that, was it a far cry to think he could arrange a train robbery and murder any witnesses?
"Surely, you don't think..."
Isaac leveled his gaze on me.
"We need to have a look at those ledgers."
Chapter 26 Remy waited next to their rental car while Sam put their suitcases in the trunk. Oliver reluctantly handed over his own suitcase.
"Do you really think this is necessary?" he asked as Sam put it in next to the other two, then closed the lid.
"Staying somewhere else?"
"Definitely."
"Because," Remy said, seeing how worried the man looked, "if Selma finds out where these two other cars are located, we'll be ready to go."
When Sam looked over at her, as he walked around to the driver's door, she raised her brows, tilting her head toward Oliver. The man had enough to worry about without the added burden of what might happen if they stayed at Peyton Manor.
"Right," Sam said. "Save us a trip back here. The sooner we get all this information together, the better for your uncle."
"Didn't think of that," Oliver replied, taking the back seat behind Remy as Sam slid into the driver's seat.
Remy smiled at Oliver, glad to see he appeared relaxed. The real reason they had him pack a bag was that they didn't trust that they'd be safe at the manor.
That morning, just before dawn, Sam had awoken to a dog barking. When he got up and looked out the window, he'd seen someone in the distance watching the house. The moment the sun came up, the man drove off in a dark sedan. Not that he or Remy had been surprised, especially after everything that had happened these past few days. It did, however, give them reason to suspect that Oliver might not be safe if left on his own. Something he'd actually considered, pointing out that a few days' rest would help his injured arm heal faster. The events concerning his uncle and the estate were beginning to wear on him, and the effects were obvious. He jumped at the slightest sound, and the circles under his eyes grew darker each day. About 10 minutes down the road, Remy looked back and saw that he'd fallen fast asleep. When he started snoring, Sam checked the rearview mirror, then Remy.
"Didn't want to say anything, but we've been followed since we left the estate."
Remy looked in the side mirror, seeing a dark-colored vehicle in the distance. Oliver lived far enough out in the country that traffic on these roads was infrequent. They still had miles to go before they hit the motorway, where they could easily lose the car in traffic.
"Watchful eye," she said, keeping her voice low. "For now." He patted his Smith & Wesson in the holster hidden in his jacket. "If they get any closer, take a tire out." She slipped her 9mm Sig Sauer from the glove box, placing it along her right thigh in case it was needed. The car, however, kept a safe distance, the driver apparently content to simply follow. For now. When they finally neared the motorway, Remy pulled out her phone and accessed the map app, the address of the mechanic already entered. Chad Williams lived in a small village north of London, which meant they still had several hours of driving, and several hours of being tailed. She glanced in the side mirror, noting the car was still behind them. "What are the chances it's just someone heading to London like we are?" "I'd believe it, if I hadn't seen them watching the house this morning. Same car. The good news is, it's only one car." When Sam hit the motorway, he headed north instead of south. The car followed, matching their speed. After 10 or 15 minutes, Sam pulled alongside a bank of cargo trucks, coasting next to them. "Keep an eye on our tail," he told Remy, his eyes locked on the rearview mirror. A moment later, he braked sharply, veering the car between two of the trucks. Unable to squeeze in behind them, the sedan drove alongside their car, the driver glancing over. Remy took a picture with her cell phone. "Looks familiar," she said, as Sam coasted along between the two trucks, watching for the next exit. When they reached it, Sam suddenly turned off. Their tail, however, was unable to make the lane change in time and continued on down the motorway. Oliver stirred as Sam braked to a stop. "Something wrong?" "Took a wrong turn," Sam said, driving beneath the overpass to get on the motorway going in the opposite direction. Oliver nodded, sat back, and within a few minutes was asleep again. "Why that exit?" Remy asked. "Not that I was worried, but there were 4 other exits before that could have gotten you back on the motorway as quickly." "Because his next exit is 8 miles from here, depending on how fast he drives, or if he wants to risk backing up with all that traffic hurtling toward him. That should buy us at least 10 or 15 minutes. "Clever, Fargo." She watched the exit in her mirror, saw nobody else taking it. "Looks like we're in the clear. For now." She enlarged the picture she'd taken for a better view. "One of our 2 friends from Pebble Beach. Followed us all the way out here. As entertaining as we are, people just gravitate toward us." Sam laughed. "Have you ever considered that we should tone it down a bit? Explore a more sedentary life?" Remy looked over at him. "Right. You let me know when you're ready and I'll start researching our options. What were you thinking of? Gardening? Needlepoint? Worthy hobbies? For someone who enjoys that sort of thing. You? Not in your DNA. Skydiving or spelunking, maybe?" "Hmm." He looked over at her as she typed something into her phone. "What are you doing?" "Sending that photo to Selma to go with that video you took on the train. Maybe we can get an ID." "Done," she said, pressing the send button. "Now, about your new hobbies." They passed several small villages, on through rolling green hills dotted with cottages, farmhouses, and scattered sheep. Once they left the motorway, Oliver awoke, surprised to find how far they'd driven. He pointed toward a church spire in the distance. "That's Chad's village. First right after the church." Sam turned onto a cobblestone street, following Oliver's directions until they'd reached Chad's shop. Oliver directed him around the corner. "Easier to park over here. His aunt lives just down the street. He uses her carriage house to work on one of his classic cars." Sam turned, parking about midway between Chad's shop and his aunt's carriage house. When the 3 of them walked up to the shop, they discovered the garage doors locked tight and a closed sign hanging in the window. Oliver nodded in the other direction. "Let's try the office," he said. "Maybe he's taking a break." He led them down a graveled path that led along the side of Chad's shop. "Ah, yes. See? The door's open." He started forward, but Sam blocked him with his arm. "Wait here," he said, drawing his gun. which was when Remy noticed the splintered door jamb. Chapter 27
Sam aimed his gun toward the office door, signaling for Remy to cover his back and Oliver to remain behind while he checked the shop. Standing to one side of the threshold, he listened a moment, not hearing a sound. Two steps in, he saw the shop's office had been ransacked. A desk chair was turned over, the drawers opened, and file cabinets emptied. Another door led to the garage where a late-model blue BMW was parked, driver's door ajar. Other than that, the car looked relatively untouched. Not so the rolling tool chest with all its drawers opened. Same with the doors of the metal cabinets along one wall. The place, however, was empty, and he returned outside. Someone was looking for something, he said, stepping aside so they could see.
Oh, no.
Oliver stood in the doorway, shaking his head.
He's not here, Sam finished for him. Thank goodness, he replied.
You don't happen to know what car he drives? It took a moment for Oliver to draw his attention from the ransacked office.
Sorry?
Car?
Oh, right. When he drove out to Peyton Manor, he was in a yellow Renault. But he also drives a lorry for the cars.
Sam walked up to Remy, saying quietly, "Call the police. I'm going to take a look and see if the car is parked anywhere nearby." He walked around to the front, then back through the alley. The flatbed tow truck was there, but the car wasn't.
"What about this carriage house you said he uses?"
Oliver's expression brightened.
"Of course he'd be there. Why didn't I think of that?"
He led them down the street, stopping in front of a driveway that led to a garage behind a two-story house, both half-timbered with high-peaked thatched roofs.
"Chad's aunt lives here," he said. "She doesn't drive, so let's him use the carriage house."
"The police are on their way," Remy said, joining them. Sam tugged on the lock hanging from the hasp on the garage doors.
"Oliver, maybe you should wait by the shop. Let me know when the police arrive."
Remy eyed the lock, turned to Oliver, smiled. "I'll meet you there in just a minute." She waited until he was gone, then stood guard while Sam picked the lock and slid open the door. He did a double take when he turned on the light switch, saw the antique gray Rolls-Royce parked inside. Remy stepped in after him.
"Is it?"
When his eyes adjusted to the interior light and he saw the weld marks and color differences of the body, he shook his head. "Too short. Maybe in early 2025. Remy found a clipboard filled with papers on the workbench. She lifted a page, followed by several more, saying, "Frankenrolls." Pieced together, apparently. The rebuilt engines from one car, the body another, and the chassis. "Well, if I'm reading this receipt correctly, it's a replica."
"I guess we know his specialty," he said, looking around at all the various body parts stacked in the corners and hanging on the walls, along with engine parts. "Could probably cannibalize everything in here and put together a fairly decent car."
He returned his attention to the rebuilt car. Not exactly a prime specimen. There was some rust on the body, and the seats were clearly in need of reupholstering. The body was similar to that of the Gray Ghost, even down to the color of the torn leather upholstery, and he wondered if it had also been built by Barker Coachworks. Remy lowered the clipboard and looked around.
"You get the feeling that whoever was here meant to come back?"
"Definitely," he said. The vehicle's engine was exposed, the tool chest rolled up right next to it, and sitting on top of the chest was a full mug of coffee and an ashtray, where a cigarette had burned into one long ash. He walked Remy out. "Do me a favor. Stay with Oliver until the police arrive. Make sure he's on the same page as us. I'd rather keep our involvement low-key."
"Easy enough. What are you planning on doing?"
"Have a better look around. Whatever happened, the guy left in a hurry. It'd be nice to know why." He looked at the house, saw a white-haired woman peering out the window at them. The curtain dropped, and a moment later she opened the back door, waved.
"Over here," she said.
The woman's smile faded as Sam and Remy approached.
"Oh, you're not the plumber?"
"Actually," Remy said, "my husband is very handy with a wrench. Just show him what you need done."
She looked over at Sam, her green eyes twinkling. I'll go check on Oliver. With no other choice, he smiled at the woman. What is it you need help with?
A clogged garbage disposal. I was rather hoping you were the plumber. Chad said he'd call one for me.
How long ago was that? Sam asked.
Well, this morning, of course. He was helping me, but something happened and he had to leave. He did say he'd call someone. But then that was 5 hours ago.
How often do you see him?
Every morning, working on that car out there before he starts work at his shop. Heaven knows what he finds so fascinating about that rusty old thing.
Sam followed her into the kitchen, eyeing the half-filled bucket sitting beneath the open drain trap. What happened?
Potato peels. My garbage disposal didn't like it much better than the celery that got stuck last week.
He picked up the pipe wrench from the floor in front of the cupboard. They don't like carrot peels either. She sighed.
I'm not sure my disposal likes anything. Chad keeps telling me I should replace it.
Any idea where he went off to? Sam asked, climbing beneath the sink to empty the peels that were stuck in the trap.
I have no idea. He just loosened the pipe when he got a phone call. Talked for a couple of minutes, then left.
That right? Sam asked, clearing the pipe, fitting it back into place. Wonder where he took off to.
Wherever it was, he was in a hurry.
He gave one last twist with the wrench. If you have a towel, I'll wipe this down for you.
Thank you. That's very kind of you, she said, picking up one from the counter. Hard for me to get down there these days.
Sam mopped up the water that had spilled, got up, held the towel over the sink, wringing it out. Don't suppose you heard what they were talking about?
You can hear for yourself. He left a message on my machine. Something about a ghost.
Chapter 28 A ghost, Sam said, as the woman handed him a clean dish towel to dry his hands.
That's what I heard. I wasn't trying to eavesdrop. It's just that he had the call on speaker while he was working under the sink. It was all very odd. Something about how they knew he'd taken their ghost and to bring it back. He said he didn't know what they were talking about. All he had was a phantom. Honestly, I have no idea what it was about. Something he didn't want to talk about in front of me because when he saw me walk in, he picked up the phone and turned off the speaker.
She offered an apologetic smile.
I would have left to give him privacy, but before I knew it, he was racing out the door.
Did he say where he was going?
No, but later he said he'd call a plumber for me. I don't think he did, though, or someone would have come by now, don't you think?
Probably. Sam ran the faucet, turned on the disposal. Good as new, he said, as he shut them off.
I can't thank you enough. How much do I owe you for this?
Glad to help. He nodded at the telephone on the wall. You were saying something about Chad leaving a message?
Yes. I was outside, and the recording came on before I could get to the phone.
She pressed a button on the answering machine, stood back so he could hear.
It's me. Oliver is on his way there, and he's not answering his phone. I need you to get a message to him. There...
The sound of the phone picking up, then...
Chad, is that you? Why are you talking so soft? Just get this message to Oliver. He's on his way. What about my sink? You said you'd fix it. I'll call for a plumber later. Can you get the message to Oliver? Of course. Tell him to bring the ghost or... I have to go. Chad?
The line went dead. The woman smiled at Sam.
That's it. All very strange. I have no idea what he's mixed up in. Something to do with those cars, probably.
As much as Sam didn't want to alarm the woman, clearly the man sounded stressed. I'd be glad to pass on the message to Oliver. Would you mind if I recorded it on my phone? Then he can hear it for himself.
Is he here?
Just down the street, at Chad's shop.
Oh, did he bring his uncle? I should go say hello.
She made a beeline for the front door, opened it, stopped at the sight of a police car. Her expression was one of mild curiosity, not something Sam expected to see.
"The police are still here?" she asked. "I thought they'd left already."
"You know what happened?"
"Someone broke into Chad's shop last night. He was here at the time, thank goodness. I told him it wasn't a good idea to live there after the last break-in."
Shaking her head, she watched as Remy and Oliver walked the constable back to his car, waved as he drove off.
"This used to be such a quiet village."
"There was another break-in?" Sam asked.
"A couple of weeks ago. Probably just some vandals, since nothing was taken." "Still..."
She gave a tired sigh.
"I don't think I'll mention this to my sister. She keeps telling me I need to sell this place, but I won't. I like it here."
Giving a determined nod, she looked at Sam.
"I'm sure you have better things to do than listen to an old woman. And I have a sink full of dirty dishes that need washing."
"Apparently the burglary was already reported," Remy told Sam when he returned. "So I heard," he said. He played the recording of the phone call for Oliver. "Any idea why he thinks you have the ghost?"
"None," Oliver said. "Can you play it again?"
He listened, shook his head.
"Why would he accuse me of having it? He knows it was stolen from the show."
"Maybe," Remy said, "he thinks your uncle took it and now you have it. After all, it's still missing."
"I don't know why."
He sat in a chair looking perplexed. "This is getting more complicated by the second. I'm beginning to regret talking my uncle out of taking that offer for Peyton Manor and the car. It wasn't near enough to settle his debts, but it might have kept him out of jail." He sighed, then stared out the window, looking lost. Sam was about to give a few words of encouragement when he thought about what Oliver just said. "Can you give me the details on this offer you were talking about?"
"Surely I mentioned that."
"Of course he did," Remy said. "They didn't want to sell because of the tenants."
"I realize that. I'm more interested in if they specifically mentioned the Grey Ghost when they made the offer for Peyton Manor."
Oliver drew away from the window.
"Well, yes. Which is what made it so attractive. Just what Remy said. He refused to guarantee that our tenants could remain on the property."
Sam and Remy exchanged glances, Remy's brows going up in question. "Who?" they both asked at the same time. Oliver didn't seem to hear them, and Sam crouched down in front of him so that he had no choice but to hear. "Who made the offer, Oliver?"
"Some distant relative, from what I understand."
"Do you recall the name?"
"Heavens, no. I didn't handle it. Allegra did."
"Why?" Sam stood, looking over at Remy, who was already typing distant relative into her phone, probably texting Selma. "Maybe it's related to all this."
"Related? How?"
"The sudden interest in the car, his offer, and the fact it was stolen."
"But this?"
He nodded to the mess inside Chad's shop.
"Part of it?"
"No doubt. Try calling again." Oliver called the number, his eyes widening when someone answered.
"Chad, we've been trying to reach you. Where?"
He listened a moment, then said, "Yes. Okay." Disconnecting, he stared at the phone's screen for several seconds. "What's going on?" Sam asked.
"I'm not sure.
But he says he'll tell us when he gets here. He's just a few minutes away." Chapter 29. Taking no chances, Sam gripped the butt of his gun while he kept a close eye on the street, waiting for Chad's arrival. When his yellow Renault finally pulled up, Sam made sure Chad was the only one in it and not being followed. "Looks like he's alone." Oliver met him at the door.
"Whatever's going on? Your aunt said something about the ghost?"
"They think I have it," Chad said. "Why?" Sam asked.
"I have no idea," he replied, just seeming to notice Sam and Remy for the first time. "Who are you?"
"My friends," Oliver said. "I told you about them when I called last night. Sam and Remy Fargo."
"I didn't know you were bringing them here."
"Why wouldn't I? They're helping me and my uncle."
"By..."
He looked at the mess around him.
"Second time, you know.
This happened before? Sam asked. He nodded. A few weeks ago, right after Oliver and his uncle had the ghost brought here. Any idea what they were looking for? Sam asked. Then or now? Either. They had to be looking for the ghost. It wasn't here at the time, Sam said. He shook his head. I kept it in my aunt's carriage house. No way was I keeping that car here. Her entire house has alarms and cameras. Same with the carriage house. This place isn't? It is. Either I didn't set it or they got past it somehow. Probably the latter, Sam realized. Chad started to pick up some of the papers on the floor that had been pulled from the desk drawers, pausing as he looked around.
Why? Why would they think I even have it? That first time I thought it was kids.
Until today. He looked at the papers he'd gathered from the floor, his expression lost.
Here, Remy said, taking the items from him. You should sit. Can I get you some water?
He nodded as he sank into the desk chair, looking around the room.
None of this makes any sense. Why trash my office? Clearly the car's not here.
Maybe looking for an address, Sam said. Somewhere you might hide it.
Except I don't have it, nor do I know where it is.
Your aunt mentioned something about a phone call, Sam said, when you were over there this morning.
Oh, no. He started to rise. I told her I'd call a plumber.
Remy returned with a bottle of water from the compact refrigerator beneath the counter. Sam took care of it for you. Chad looked at Sam.
Thank you.
She was a little surprised when you went tearing out of there, Sam said. What was that about?
This bloke just started accusing me of stealing the ghost. It didn't matter what I told him. He said if I didn't deliver it, I'd be sorry.
His hand shook so hard as he twisted off the bottle cap, he spilled the water in his lap.
Are you okay?
Remy asked, taking the bottle from him.
No.
Suddenly he dropped his head into his hands and started sobbing.
Sam.
Sam placed his hand on the man's shoulder.
What's going on?
It was several seconds before he looked up, trying to catch his breath.
When I got the call from that man,
He sucked in a breath of air, looking dazed.
I could hear her cuckoo clock. He was calling from my mother's house.
You're sure? Chad nodded. This time when Remy handed him the bottle, he drank several sips, then wiped his mouth and eyes with the back of his hand.
I drove out there to see for myself. Once I saw the car out front, I knew.
Knew what? Sam asked.
The bloke who called. He was there. I couldn't even go in. Just peeked through the window from the side yard like the coward I am.
He looked at Remy, his eyes pleading.
What am I going to do? She's not involved in any of this.
His head went down again as another sob escaped his throat.
This is all my fault.
Definitely something more going on here than any of them realized. Sam stood, angling his head at Remy to take over since she was far better at getting information from someone who was emotionally upset. She moved in, taking Sam's place.
Why would you think it's your fault?
This time, he looked directly at Oliver.
I'm not the expert you thought I was. I made it all up for the money. I can work on cars, yes. But everything I know comes from the Internet. But...
Oliver stared for a moment, his stricken look turning to one of anger.
You assured me you were the best. I saw your website. All those photos. Those awards. My uncle's.
Why? Chad shrugged.
Would you have brought that car to me if you knew the only Rolls-Royce I'd ever worked on without my uncle was the one in my aunt's garage?
Of course not.
See?
Oliver started to say something, but Remy cut in.
You must know something about these cars. After all, you got the ghost up and running. When my uncle was alive, collectors would bring their cars to his shop for repair. He taught me everything he knew. After he died, no one was willing to take a chance on me. So when I read that article about the Paytons finding the Grey Ghost, I made up a website and called them. And Well, you know the rest.
Sam moved next to Remy, hoping to get the conversation back on track. About your mother. Was someone threatening her?
No. But I'm sure whoever it is means to.
Why do you think that?
Even after I told him I didn't have the Grey Ghost, he said he wasn't interested in my excuses. Deliver the car or face the consequences. The thing is, I don't have it. The last I saw of it was here at my shop, when we were putting it on that lorry for delivery to the London Motor Show. That's it. I swear.
Well, someone seems to think you have it, Sam said.
Yes. And whoever this man is, he's sitting there drinking tea with my mother as though they were the best of friends.
At least she doesn't know what's going on. Not helping, Sam, Remy said under her breath. Louder, she asked, how do we get her out of there?
Call the police, Oliver said.
Something that Sam had already considered and dismissed. The last thing they wanted was a hostage situation, or anyone getting shot. One thing we're sure of, Sam said, is that these guys have no problem pulling guns. I'm not sure I want to pit them against unarmed village constables.
What other choice do we have? Chad asked.
Storm the castle and get her out. Chapter 30. The first thing they did was bring up a satellite map image of the village where Chad's mother lived, about 15 minutes to the north. Sam and Remy studied the map while Chad described the neighborhood, pointing to the middle of an S-shaped street. The main problem, Chad said, is that her house is right at the center of the S. No matter which direction you approach from, her parlor window and front door have a view of the street. If this guy's looking out the window to the right, he'll see you coming before you see him. The only place that might work is on the west end of the street. My mum's hedge runs the length of her driveway, and you have to move out past the hedge to the street to actually see the corner here at the top of the hill.
How'd you get a look without being seen? Sam asked.
Through the park behind her house.
He ran his finger along an expanse of green that paralleled the next street over.
There's a gate that leads from the park to her backyard. It's overgrown with ivy, so I went in through that, up the side yard, then looked in through the kitchen window. He was sitting in the front parlor, watching the street. There's no way he even knows the gate's there.
And there was only one man.
Just the one.
Sam studied the map a bit longer. It could work.
Remy, you could hole up at the top of the hill. I come in through the back gate. Oliver, you're at the park with the car running. Chad makes the call, draws him out. Remy signals me that he's past the hedge. I go in, get your mom, and we're good to go.
What if he takes her out with him? Chad asked. Like a hostage.
The fact your mother doesn't know she's a hostage makes it clear he's trying to keep it low-key. Last thing he's going to want to do is draw attention to his presence. What he didn't mention was that Remy's presence at the top of the hill with her gun was in case of that very scenario. No sense in alarming either Chad or Oliver. For this to work, he needed them calm.
You good with that, Remy?
Definitely, she said,
giving a slight pat to the small of her back where her SIG was holstered.
How are we going to draw him out? Chad asked.
All you need to do is tell him you're parked at the top of the street. He has to walk out past the hedge. Get him out that far, we're good.
It's all about the setup. We need him to believe you have the car.
How?
First thing, Sam said, we call your mother and get a handle on what it is we're dealing with. Be reluctant. If you're too eager to give details, you might spook the guy. After Sam went over a few pointers and details, Chad turned on the speaker of his cell phone and redialed the number.
What is it you want from me? He asked the man who answered.
The Grey Ghost.
What makes you think I have it?
A reliable source, the man said. And your dear sweet mum informs us that you've been working on it at your shop.
Clearly, you've been here.
Yes. And clearly, it's not there.
Where is it?
Chad looked at Sam, who nodded, encouraging him to stick with their script.
Somewhere safe. I want assurances that my mother's not hurt.
I'll let you talk to her yourself.
There was a muffled noise, then his mother's voice saying, "Chad, is that you?"
"It's me, Mum. Are you okay?"
"What a silly question. Of course I'm okay. I'm having such a lovely time with two of your mates. I was showing them your website and telling them all about the car you're working on. That grey one. You're coming by with it, aren't you?"
Sam and Remy glanced at each other, Remy reaching for the pen.
"Mum, as you can see, she's fine. Waiting for you. And the grey ghost."
"Yes," they heard his mother saying in the background. "One of those ghost names."
Remy wrote "time" and "stall," pointed at the paper. Chad nodded, saying,
"It's going to take a few hours. I don't have it here with me."
"So you've finally come to your senses," the man on the other end said. "You have 3 hours to deliver the car to us, or else."
"I need more."
The line went dead. "So much for storming the castle," Remy said. "Remy's right," Sam replied.
"Why?" Chad asked. "You said this would work."
Oliver eyed the both of them, looking aghast.
"I know I was against this, but you can't mean to just leave her there."
"We're not," Sam said, "but that plan's out. You heard your mother. She said two of your friends, as in more than one. That changes the odds significantly."
"But you both have guns," Oliver said. "You can't leave her there."
"That's the last thing we intend to do," Sam said. "It's just that after hearing their conversation, the plan we came up with won't work."
"No," Remy said, "but I have the perfect plan B."
Chapter 31.
"That's insane," Oliver said when Remy finished outlining her plan to the three of them. "You're asking us to make something out of nothing. It'll never work."
"It's brilliant," Sam said. "It could totally work." Remy turned to Chad.
"She's your mother. You're the one who has to make the final decision. And you're the only one who knows if we have half a chance of pulling this off."
Chad stared at the same spot on the floor for several seconds, clearly wrestling with the decision. Finally, he looked up at her, and then Sam, his dark eyes troubled.
"I'm not saying yes. I need to know, how do we keep my mother from getting hurt?"
"That part's easy," Sam said. "Kind of like the old plan. They're more interested in the car than her."
"Except in this case," Remy said, "we intend to deliver."
Chad gave a deep sigh, stood.
"Let's go take a look."
The four of them walked down to the carriage house where the Rolls was stored. Chad looked in the window, saw his aunt, gave a cheery smile and waved, his face sobering as he turned back to them.
"I'd appreciate it if you didn't mention any of this to my aunt. I'd rather not have her worried."
"Not a word," Sam said. Chad opened the door and turned on the lights.
"Anyone who's the least bit familiar with these cars will be able to tell straight away this isn't the Grey Ghost the moment they get a good look at it."
Of that, Sam had no doubt. The fact that Remy's idea was so preposterous was what made it so appealing. Who would suspect them of trying to pass off a counterfeit car as the real thing?
"Silk purse, sow's ear," Oliver muttered.
"Maybe so," Sam said. "But if we work this right, they'll never get close enough to tell."
"They won't have to," Chad replied. "The silhouette's off. The body's too short. Those fenders aren't right. Straighter than the ghost."
"Unless..."
He looked around the shop, his attention lingering on some black fenders stacked against the wall.
"We could switch them out for those. A little spray paint.
Still, this Rolls doesn't have the style of the Barker Coachworks. They'll notice that right off. Look at how level those seatbacks are."
"Any way we can fake it?" Remy asked. He circled the vehicle, eyeing it as he walked. After a while, he stopped, opened the front passenger door, climbed in, and kneeled on the seat. Suddenly he started pulling up on the leather upholstery, loosening it from the back.
"I think I can work with this.
Even if it means lessening the value of your car.
It's not like we're ripping up the Grey Ghost, trying to make it look like the lesser 2025 that it is."
He patted the back of the seat he'd just pulled up.
great for tinkering with, and learning to rebuild an engine. Other than that, it's probably worth more as a source for spare parts. "How long do you need?" Sam asked. "I dare say at least a couple of